Today we're going to be starting chemistry of carbonyl compounds. So we're going to be talking about aldehydes and ketones. We talked about nomenclature of aldehydes and ketones in lab on Wednesday. So somebody remind me what the main difference is between an aldehyde and a ketone.
H and R.
Okay, so in both cases, it's a carbonyl that only has alkyl groups or hydrogens. Well, for an aldehyde, we have to have a hydrogen attached to carbonyl. For a ketone, it can only be alkyl groups that are attached. And I mentioned that the order of priority of functional groups, the fact that aldehydes are more important than ketones, is somewhat related to the fact that aldehydes are more reactive than ketones. So can someone come up with a reasonable explanation why it is that an aldehyde is a more reactive functional group than a ketone? But before you answer that question, how many of you read the sections of the text corresponding to the syllabus which has been available? So what's the big rush for me posting the syllabus if you all don't get around to reading it? Do I need to lecture you yet again about the consequences of falling behind in this course? Because how many reactions have we already learned this quarter? Making alkyl bromides, alkyl chlorides, alkyl iodides, tosylates, doing a dehydration, using sodium hydride to deprotonate an alcohol, using sodium metal itself to deprotonate an alcohol. Those are going to be the mechanisms we learned today. Do we need any more reason not to get behind? What is the reason that an aldehyde is more reactive than a ketone? Yes? Okay. So it has to do with the difference in charge on the carbon and the oxygen of the carbonyl. Because if we did look at something like an aldehyde, oxygen is a more electronegative element, so it's going to be partially negatively charged. Carbon, therefore, is going to be partially positively charged. And there are two flavors of reactions, and we're going to see one example of each today. Cationic reactions, which involve the attack on oxygen first. Since oxygen is partially negatively charged, that's why it would interact with something that's cationic in nature. The other way to have a carbonyl react, though, is to just charge and attack the carbon. So carbon is partially positively charged. So if we had something that was anionic, it would gravitate towards that carbon center. Would somebody mind closing that door since they seem to be doing construction or something? So whether we're doing a cationic reaction or an anionic reaction, the more of a dipole that we have there, the more likely that that functional group's going to be reactive. So instead of just thinking about electron withdrawing capability, let's think of our old friend hyperconjugation. Because there is a p orbital, the way we visualize this molecule, on both the carbon and the oxygen. And in this case, we have a hydrogen there that would be perpendicular to the p orbital, wouldn't it? In fact, why don't we draw a partial structural molecular orbital graph, which for the new students to the class, yes, SMOG, this thing that we refer to as a SMOG diagram. So structural molecular orbital graph. These are diagrams that we're going to draw quite a bit when we are discussing molecular orbital theory or orbital interactions such as hyperconjugation. And what this graph represents is the types of orbitals that exist on each atom, and usually in order to show the types of overlaps that we have between orbitals on different atoms. I'm going to draw a just reduced version, though, where I'm focusing just on the pi bond of the carbonyl and then on the orbitals of what's neighboring the carbonyl. So not a full SMOG diagram. So here's our single bond that exists, but in any kind of pi bond, we would normally have a set of p orbitals as well. When we're doing SMOG diagrams, the general habit I have is not to show the phase of the wave function, but just to show the type of orbital that we have present. So generally, p orbitals I shade in as red. Again, if I was worried about sine, I would need to shade the top and the bottoms of these orbitals different colors. But I'm just focusing on the fact they are p orbitals. We then have What kind of orbital coming off of the carbon to then join with the hydrogen? What would be the hybridization of the carbon at that point? SP2. So I'll show one of the three SP2 orbitals that comes off the carbon. Now, for new people as well, hybrid orbitals technically have a nodal plane through them, meaning that they have a plus and a minus half just like a P orbital. It's just that hybrid orbitals are lopsided in terms of the size of the two lobes. But for simplicity's sake, I don't draw the two lobes on the diagram because then we start getting a clutter of bubbles. So this is just showing the major lobe of the SP2 hybrid. The whole point of this diagram is to show that the hydrogen and the carbon form, the p orbital from the carbon, I should say, form a 90 degree angle with each other. And since there's a 90 degree angle, there's no overlap, and so the hydrogen provides no form of stabilization to the p orbital. So in an aldehyde, the hydrogen attached to the carbonyl is unable to hyperconjugate with the carbonyl itself. Since the bond to hydrogen is perpendicular to the pi bond. But if we had a ketone where there was no hydrogen, where on both sides of the carbonyl we would have an alkyl group, different situation exists. Let me go ahead and do a full SMOG diagram this time just for the benefit of the newer students. And we'll look at this molecule, acetone. You need to know that as a common name for this molecule because it's almost never referred to as propane 2-one, its proper name. Acetone's the common name. So in acetone, we have three carbons. What's the hybridization again of the central carbon? Now, how do we know what the hybridization is? What's the rule for determining hybridization? Double bond only counts as one type of bond because the sigma bond counts in Vesper theory, but the pi bond does not. And in fact, to figure out hybridization, you count the number of sigma bonds and the number of lone pairs. So on the carbon that's in the carbonyl, it has a total of three sigma bonds, so it needs three hybrid orbitals, which is why it's sp2 hybridized. The methyl groups all have four bonds. Those require four hybrids. That's why it's sp3 hybridized. So the central carbon being sp2 hybridized, it's going to have three orbitals on it. The oxygen, if we're following this method, is going to have an sp2 hybridization as well. There's then the p orbitals, and then on either end of the carbon, there's then an sp3 hybridized carbon. And of course, each of those end orbitals on the sp3s has a hydrogen. Let's not forget to show the fact we have a pi bond there. And let me fill in the sp2s. So here's the guide, purple. It's what I usually use for sp3. Blue for sp2, as we saw up above, and red is p orbital. Point here is that we have hyperconjugation possible. So one of the carbon-hydrogen bonds, a sigma bond, is able to provide some extra electrodensity into that carbonyl. The carbon of the carbonyl is already delta positive because of the electronegativity of oxygen. So this is offsetting that delta positive a little bit. Well, if you offset that delta positive, effectively making it less delta positive, you're making the carbonyl bond less polar and therefore less reactive. And that's why carbonyls in ketones are less reactive than aldehydes. So in a ketone, both groups attach to the carbonyl. Are able to undergo hyperconjugation with the carbonyl. Hyperconjugation effectively reduces the partial positive charge on the carbon. Which therefore makes the carbonyl less polar and less reactive. Now later on in the quarter, we're going to learn about conjugation, where instead of just this partial overlap that we have from a neighbor sigma bond, instead if we had a pi bond next door where you could have complete overlap, we're going to see that that has an even more profound effect on structure and reactivity. And then even later in the quarter, we're going to hit benzene, which is like conjugation that's been souped up. So questions about the difference between the reactivity of aldehydes and ketones? Alrighty, let's learn one of the two main reactions I wanted to cover today. And part of the reason that I'm showing this to you is, one, we did have this discussion of oxidation to form ketones. Then the very next lab is going to be reduction of ketones. But I mentioned just earlier today that there's this duality in the way that carbonyls react, that you can have cationic reactions and anionic reactions. So next lecture, we're going to talk about oxidation of alcohols. We're going to see a mechanism. Besides the bleach mechanism for the lab, in lecture, we're going to talk about chromium oxidation agents. Well, there's a side reaction that can occur when you're oxidizing a primary alcohol. And we're going to see just that side reaction today. Because both aldehydes and ketones can form a compound called a hydrate, which, if I just wrote it out in terms of synthesis, the reaction would be taking a aldehyde or ketone, reacting it with water and some kind of acid catalyst. The end product is that we lose the carbonyl bond, and we've added effectively another alcohol. So another term for a hydrate would be a geminal diol. Geminal, if you don't remember, that's like Gemini, the twins, the constellation. So geminal means twin diol, meaning both of the OH groups are located on the same carbon. This is, in fact, a reversible reaction. So let me change the arrow that I'm using here. So we already saw a reversible mechanism on Wednesday when we talked about hydration and dehydration. Well, this is very similar to hydration of an alkene. The reactivity is a little different here because this hydrate is normally not thermodynamically favorable. It's very small aldehydes forming a hydrate is actually a favorable reaction. In fact, just as a little side note here, I mentioned this out loud the other day, but the systematic name of this aldehyde is formaldehyde, which comes from formica, which is Latin for ant, and formic acid is, in fact, one of the compounds that's in some forms of ant stings, the stinging component of an ant sting. Formaldehyde will react with water favorably to form a hydrate because it forms something that has OH groups which are very similar to the structure of water. But the larger, well, once you've put an R group on, and then the larger the R group is, the less polar the molecule is, the less likely it would be water compatible, and it turns out the less likely it would want to be to form a hydrate. Let's see the mechanism for this reaction. And this general style of mechanism I'm about to show you, you're going to do over and over and over and over again all the way up through a good chunk of Chem-12C. That's also part of the reason I'm introducing it to you now, because it is going to be so heavily repeated during the entire quarter. The first step of the reaction is much like what we had when we tried to throw acid and water at an alcohol. Because really, there's nothing likely to happen with this molecule except to have oxygen be protonated. Now, later on, we'll learn situations where that's not quite true. Because remember that this is a cationic mechanism that I'm showing you. And that's why the oxygen's what gets involved first. Later on, when we have a strong enough base, it will be the carbon that reacts first. But focusing on this particular reaction, acetone gets protonated. Then realize this is now a delocalized ion. The carbonyl we can show on paper as opening up. Now remember, resonance structures are fake because there isn't really resonance. It's just the fact that we can't write a delocalized system properly using standard line drawings. But I'll show this as its own individual step where you have a bond open. We have formed a carbocation now, which if we're in a solution where there's a lot of water, water can now attack. And as we will see a zillion times over, when we form an oxonium ion in this matter, it's then going to lose a hydrogen to deprotonate. So protonate, open, attack, deprotonate. I'll sometimes abbreviate that sequence with this acronym PODE. Came up with it only because you're going to see it so many dozens of times. Now, just to do what we did similarly on Wednesday when we saw a reversible reaction, let's draw the reverse reaction mechanism from taking a hydrate and going back to an aldehyde or a ketone. This example was a ketone going to a hydrate. Let me start with a hydrate of an aldehyde, just to have done an aldehyde, and see it going backwards. The way that you can tell that we started with an aldehyde versus a ketone is at the point where the two OH groups meet, that has to be where the carbonyl carbon was. You can see that I've got a hydrogen attached next door to what must have been the carbonyl carbon, and so I know I can predict that this is an aldehyde or going to be an aldehyde. principle of microscopic reversibility. I used that phrase the other day in class. If you don't remember exactly what that is, it's the idea that if you have any process, whatever the easiest way to go forward through that process will, in the reverse direction, automatically be the same pathway that you would take in the reverse direction. And the example that I often give is, imagine that you're climbing over a mountain. Well, if you find the easiest path over, there's not going to be another easier pathway back, because if there is, that's the one you would have taken the first time to get over in the first place. So every step that happens in the forward reaction is exactly the same step that's going to happen in reverse in the reverse reaction, just as we saw the other day. So last step, again, here is a proton coming off. First step in the reverse is going to be that proton hopping back on. We've made water, which now is a leaving group. We now have a carbonyl or a carbocation that is adjacent to an oxygen. Therefore, we rapidly can have a resonance structure. There is no resonance structure. It's delocalized, but we can write formally the fact that it's delocalizing, and then show that hydrogen coming off the positively charged oxygen to make the neutral carbonyl. Notice that it just so happens we can label these steps as protonate, open, attack, deprotonate. Slightly different actions are happening this time, but the same acronym applies. That's partly, again, the reason for making this acronym. So if you can remember that sequence, protonate, open, attack, deprotonate, you can remember both the forward and reverse reactions. Now, there is a slight technicality in terms of the way we could write this mechanism. Now, you can write the mechanism just as I have, or you could realize that because the carbonyl, once it's protonated, that is a delocalized ion, it is perfectly valid in the forward reaction, where we're showing the carbonyl being protonated and then opening. There's no reason we can't write that as simply one step. So again, because once the carbonyl is protonated, it's delocalized, there's some legitimacy in writing the mechanism combined in this way, where you show the opening simultaneous with protonation. So you can do either method that you would prefer. Questions on this reaction? Right? Then this is an example of a cationic mechanism, and I know I must have made the statement a few times now, but I want to put it in print right here. Cationic reactions, especially involving acid catalysts, are normally reversible. Why? Well, because whatever protonated oxygen intermediate we make, they're all pretty much equally as bad as each other. So if you could get it to happen in the forward direction, it's no harder for it to happen in the reverse direction. So no one intermediate is so much more unstable than the other, in other words, that we get stuck at some point in the reaction. That is not true many times in the case of anionic reactions. And so let's, in fact, now see the opposite type of situation. And our example is going to be reduction. There are two very common major reducing agents that you need to be familiar with. One of them is NaBH4, sodium borohydride. The other one, LiAlH4, lithium aluminum or aluminium hydride. Both very common, but when possible, sodium borohydride is generally used instead of lithium borohydride. Now let's see if we can come up with a rationalization as to why. Which element is in the same column as boron? Does anybody remember what other elements are in the same column as boron on the periodic table? Na?
Lithium.
That's beryllium. So it's hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, Be, and then boron. Well, I see someone's got the periodic table in front of her. So what are the elements that come below boron?
Aluminum.
Aluminum is in the same column as boron. So because aluminum, though, is below boron, which element is more electronegative? Boron is more electronegative, okay? But between hydrogen and boron, which element is more electronegative? Hydrogen. Remember, that's why in the hydroboration reaction, boron ends up acting as the electrophile, making hydrogen act like H minus. Backwards of most other electrophilic reactions, which is why hydroboration is an anti-Markovnikov addition. So if boron is already less electronegative than hydrogen, and aluminum is a less electronegative than boron, then that means there's an even greater electronegativity difference between aluminum hydrogen than there is in boron and hydrogen, which is the explanation for why the hydride in lithium aluminum hydride is so much more reactive than in sodium borohydride. Sodium borohydride, in fact, can be dissolved in alcohols, things that will react in a side reaction with the reagent itself. But the reagent will decompose at a slow enough rate that if you had an aldehyde or a ketone present, it will still get reduced. The reaction I'm going to show you will still happen, even though it's in a very bad choice of solvent. We take advantage of that in real life because sodium borohydride is also relatively inexpensive. So if we use a little excess, no problem. Throw a little excess in some methanol, throw in whatever ketone or aldehyde, shake it around, and 90-something percent yield. It's a fantastic reaction. Lithium aluminum hydride also will work, but the dry powder itself, if you let it sit around in air, will eventually ignite because it that violently reacts with the water in the air. In fact, back at the research lab that I was at when I was a graduate student, the next door lab, which is part of our same group, the one major fire we almost had while I was there at Berkeley was because he was using some lithium aluminum hydride. He filtered it out of reaction. It did get a little too dry, and it just caught on fire, which considering there was some solvent around, then that solvent then caught on fire, which almost caught something else on fire, which also almost caught that whole room on fire. So, yeah, that's chemistry. That's graduate-level chemistry. But so that's the main difference between these two reagents. Now, what we're going to see in the future is because there's a big difference in the reactivity of these two reagents, we're going to find other carbonyl groups that one reagent will touch while the other won't. First, let me just make the statement about the difference of reactivity of these two reagents. And let me summarize to say the electronegativity difference between aluminum and boron or hydrogen is greater than between boron and hydrogen. Lithium aluminum hydride is therefore a far more powerful reducing agent. Sodium borohydride is, how to say it? Sodium borohydride can be safely used in the presence of protic solvents. Decomposition will occur, but slowly enough, reduction can still occur. The side reaction would be just like we saw with sodium hydride, because sodium borohydride is effectively a source of hydride. So the side reaction would be that the sodium borohydride would neutralize the alcohol, forming an alkoxide and hydrogen gas. What's really the reaction that we want to see happen? The simplified way of showing it is the following. That if we had something, for example, like an aldehyde, we simply show the aldehyde being attacked by hydride. Later on, once we return properly to aldehydes and ketones, we may learn a slightly alternate version of this mechanism, because the boron or the aluminum sometimes does get involved in the reduction of carbonyl compounds. Sometimes that aluminum and boron will complex with the oxygen, and sometimes that complexation is key to the mechanism for that reaction. Since this is our first pass through, keeping it somewhat simplified. So hydride attacks, and notice that simultaneously you push open the carbonyl, because that carbon otherwise would have already had four bonds to it. Notice that I'm not using a reversible arrow. Because even though I can't remember the pKa offhand, I know that the pKa of hydrogen gas is much, much greater than the pKa of an alcohol. If the pKa of hydrogen gas is greater than the pKa of this alcohol, what does that mean in terms of the strength of H minus versus this alkoxide that I just formed? Which is the stronger base? So let's put this down here. H2 has the larger pKa, and an alcohol has the smaller pKa. So which of those two compounds, H2 or an alcohol, is the stronger acid? No. Remember that pKa is the negative log of the Ka. That acid dissociation constants for most organic acids are less than 1, so that means that most pKa values are big values. Bigger the value, the weaker the acid. So H2 is the weaker acid. The alcohol is therefore the stronger acid. Well, whichever is the stronger acid makes the weaker base conjugate, because a strong acid means the hydrogen wants to come off, which means the base doesn't want it back. So the alkoxide is the weaker conjugate base. H minus is the stronger conjugate base. Now I'll look this value up later, because I'll just want to know for future argument purposes, but let's just say that maybe hydrogen has a pKa of 30. The alcohol is going to have a pKa of roughly 16, since it's a primary alcohol. That's 14 orders of magnitude difference. That's a huge difference in basicity. So this reaction I've written with a forward arrow because the reagent is so much more basic than the product, it is highly unlikely the product would try to react in reverse.
So reduction is essentially an irreversible reaction because the reducing agent is far more basic than the product formed. And that leads us to another one of these general trend statements, that anionic reactions are often irreversible. Especially when there is a large difference in the basicity of the reactants versus products. So we've seen a prototypical example of a cationic reaction, showing that a carbonyl can be induced to open, to react, by first protonating the oxygen of that carbonyl. We've now also seen a prototypical example of an anionic reaction, where the carbonyl is forced open in a reaction that's effectively not reversible because of the huge difference in the basicities of the reagent you start with versus the product you get from that carbonyl. Questions? Then, I think it's about time that we make Marvin happy and we start doing some multi-step synthesis problems. So here's our first example. You will in a moment. So here we have a primary alcohol that's being converted into a primary alkyl azide. N3, if you don't remember that ion, it can be provided by the reagent NaN3, which I'll even go one step further and help remind you of one possible resonance structure for the N3 minus ion. An alcohol is not a leaving group, so this is not a one-step reaction. Design a multi-step synthesis using only that alcohol as your original source of carbon. On a quiz or an exam, this is exactly how the problem might be presented. You see the starting compound, you see the end compound, and you got to figure out how many steps there are between and what should be used in each of those steps. Does what? I'm sorry? Assume azide is a strong nucleophile. But not too basic. It is basic, but in this case, presume it's just a strong nucleophile.
Anyone have some suggestions? Yeah. Okay, why tosyl chloride? Okay. Why tosyl chloride versus something like thiamyl chloride? You actually have the right answer, though. Tosyl chloride would be a good first step. Let's approach this retrosynthetically, shall we? So retrosynthesis means start with the product and imagine what might have been there before that product had formed. So if we step back one step, in order for the azide to have reacted, we need some leaving group there instead, correct? And so I could even just leave this in a general form LG for leaving group. But the point of doing the retrosynthesis is because we have to analyze both regiochemistry and stereochemistry. And what must be the stereochemistry of the deuterium in this one previous step? Has to be a wedge, because when N3 attacked, it would have happened by SN2 substitution. Now notice that that is the same stereochemistry that we have for the original starting material. Do we know a way of converting the original starting material to a leaving group while retaining stereochemistry? The answer is yes. So if sodium azide would have been a reagent that would have been used in reverse here, then tosyl chloride in reverse would have been the reaction to get us from this alcohol. So the answer to the problem, the way you could write the answer, the way you should on an exam or quiz, is show one reagent at a time and the result of that one reagent. No mechanism is necessary on this type of problem because it's a synthesis problem. Then I would show sodium azide making the desired product with the desired stereochemistry. Shall we do another? And now, Marvin is smiling.
This is also multi-step.
This is multi-step. I suggest this may be a four-step reaction. Shall we try the retrosynthetic approach on this? Well, we end up with an alkyl chloride that is different from an alcohol, for one thing, and it's regiochemically in a different position. So part of the reason I gave you this as an example molecule, and we're going to learn how to do this a little bit more systematically as we learn more reactions, is before we even start worrying about functional groups, we want to think about carbon backbone. And if we have a reaction like this, in which you have two different positions of the molecule involved, there's only a handful of ways that you can make a position move like that. One would be carbocation rearrangement. Is it likely that carbocation rearrangement happened in this problem? Not at all, because what kind of rearrangement would have had to have happened? You would have gone from tertiary, not to secondary even, to primary. The chloride ends up in a primary carbon. That's not favorable thermodynamically, so it can't be carbocation rearrangement.
So what other ways could you have two different positions on molecules somehow be involved with each other? Okay. Well, if we had an alkene or an alkyne or epoxide. Because an epoxide has two carbons bridged by a single oxygen. So, in fact, later on when we see epoxides, we're going to learn how we can take an alcohol, if it has the right functionality around it, turn it into epoxide to then move the oxygen to the other carbon. So, let's say that this is going to involve an alkene, because it does have two carbons involved. So we're going to think retrosynthetically, at some point I want to have ended up with an alkene. Do we, as far as what this class has learned, know a way that we could have gotten this chloride directly from an alkene? The answer to that question is no. Now, if you read the text, you might find some mention of alkenes reacting with radicals, but we didn't talk about those. We only talked about alkanes reacting with radicals. So, is there some other functional group we might have been able to get this chloride from? What reactions do you know that form chlorides? Thionyl chloride, SOCl2. Or, in theory, we could have done some SN2 reaction. But you might remember the comment I made on Wednesday about alcohols being an extraordinarily common intermediate functional group in synthesis. So let's see whether that thought that maybe it came from an alcohol is on the right track. Do we know a way that we could have produced this alcohol from an alkene that would have involved these two carbons? Because it's not at the most substituted position, isn't it? But that's exactly the point of a reaction that we learned last quarter, wasn't it? That if we had used borane and then oxidized it, it could have come from this alkene. Because the primary position would have been the least substituted position. Is there a way that we could have made that alkene from the starting alcohol? Well, is that the thermodynamic alkene? Is that the thermodynamically most stable alkene? No. So we could not have done a direct dehydration. But couldn't we have done a kinetic elimination with potassium T-butoxide? Where even though you might have had the leaving group at the more substituted position, because we use a big bulky base, it makes the less stable alkene. Do we know a way to get from the original alcohol to that alkyl halide? Well, you do, but you don't know it, because you might be thrown off by the fact that it's tertiary. But it turns out that both thionyl chloride and PBr3 have alternate SN1-like mechanisms when you have tertiary substrates. So yes, you could have taken PBr3, reacted the alcohol to make a leaving group, eliminated to the less favorable position to make the alkene, hydroborated and oxidized it to make the anti-Markovnikov alcohol, which then you could have used thionyl chloride to make the alkyl chloride. What difficulty level on a scale of 1 to 10 would I assign to a problem like this? A four, maybe a three. What, you think this was a hard problem, Marvin? I think four or three is pretty fair. Are we going to get things that are more like a six or a seven? Oh, you better believe it. So when you see the example synthesis problems like this in the text, don't ignore them. Any last questions before we end for the day? Then remember, there's no class Monday. Have a nice weekend.